Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 28, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And now, to tell you a little bit more about the experts on the call, I'm going to turn it over to the moderator of today's call, John Malcolm, who is the director and Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindberg Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's also the chairman of the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group. So without any further ado, John, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. I'm delighted to be here with you all today. Let me set the stage for our discussion today. So as we all know, Congress often passes statutes that provide broad delegations to regulators to fill in the details by promulgating implementing regulations. As Justice Antonin Scalia noted in his dissenting opinion in Sykes versus United States, fuzzy legislation is attractive to the congressman who wants credit for addressing a national problem, but who does not have the time, or perhaps the votes, to grapple with the nitty-gritty. In other words, this mechanism enables legislators to claim credit when something good happens as a result of that legislation, but to disavow responsibility when an implementing agency does something that a member of the public doesn't like. That was the bureaucrat's fault. While agencies sometimes promulgate regulations that are clear and precise, sometimes they don't. Sometimes the regulations they promulgate are vague and subject to differing interpretations, some of them reasonable, some of them objectively unreasonable. Vague regulations are bad enough when enforced civilly or administratively, but they are particularly pernicious when enforced via a criminal prosecution. Such prosecutions can fly in the face of fundamental notions of fairness and contribute greatly to our burgeoning over-criminalization problem. Indeed, in a recent denial of certiorari in a case called Whitman versus United States, Justices Scalia and Thomas said that if presented with a proper case, they would be willing to examine just how much deference regulatory agencies should receive when promulgating and interpreting criminal regulations, suggesting that they believe the correct answer should be not much deference. We have two excellent speakers today to discuss a pending federal case out of Florida, United States versus Clay, that implicates many of these issues. Our first speaker, John Lauro, is an experienced trial lawyer who specializes in white-collar criminal defense in complex cases. A graduate of Georgetown Law School, John was a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York. That's the office that was at one time headed by our current Attorney General, Loretta Lynch. Prior to starting his own firm, John also worked as an associate at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius and was a partner at Zuckerman Spader. After John speaks, we will hear from Paul Kaminar. Paul is also a graduate of Georgetown Law School and now serves primarily as an appellate lawyer, having argued cases before the United States Supreme Court and several federal courts of appeal. Paul has also served as a senior executive counsel for the Washington Legal Foundation and served as a clinical professor at George Mason Law School and as an adjunct professor at Georgetown Law School. And with that, let me turn the floor over to John Lauro.
Thank you so much, John, and thank you for the introduction and all the work that you do in this very important area. And Christian, thank you for having us. This case, as John mentioned, is really an analysis of the meeting of the regulatory state and issues of overcriminalization. The case itself involves a number of high-level executives who worked at a HMO, Health Maintenance Organization, in Florida, which was required from time to time to provide reports and analyses to the state of Florida, and in particular, a bureaucratic agency called the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA. In this instance, the agency decided not to promulgate regulations regarding the reporting. The reporting involved an analysis of certain healthcare expenditures, and it required a payback in certain instances. Rather than having state regulations fill the gap, in effect, and provide a very clear enunciation to the regulatory public on how to do these calculations, the state decided instead to simply have a contract with these entities. The federal government, on the other hand, intervened. And the case involves a clear instance of prosecutors filling the gap where state regulators decided not to regulate. In other words, the federal prosecution was brought under federal health care criminal statutes in an instance where the state declined to regulate itself. The executives were charged with health care fraud for not following a standard or methodology of calculation that the federal prosecutors believed was the correct one, but where the state of Florida had admittedly and decidedly decided not to regulate and not to pass written regulations with the usual notice requirements. The reason why this case is so significant is that we are now involved in a presentation to the 11th Circuit in which the court will have an opportunity to reaffirm a decision called United States versus Whiteside, which really is a judicial analysis of whether or not the government has proceeded in a way that was fair and in a way that gave adequate notice to the regulated public. Whiteside is a very important decision for the regulated industries and also for all citizens that have to deal with the realities of responding to regulatory or bureaucratic questions. The reason why Whiteside is so critical is that Whiteside gives judges the opportunity to analyze regulatory frameworks and make decisions and determinations as to whether or not the regulated public acted in an objectively reasonable manner in responding to regulations or in the absence of regulations in responding to statutes and contracts. And in this case, we believe that the 11th Circuit has an important opportunity to reaffirm the principles of Whiteside and also provide a degree of protection against overcriminalization and instances where prosecutors try to replace bureaucrats in effecting regulations through the criminal process as opposed to the administrative process where you have the opportunity for notice, review, and comment. I'd like to talk now about the actual facts of the case, which start off simply enough with a publicly traded company called WellCare, which, as I mentioned, is a health maintenance organization in Florida that was providing medical and behavioral health care services to patients, primarily Medicaid patients in the state. Florida was moving from a fee-for-service arrangement to more of a managed care arrangement, where the state would pay in advance companies like WellCare and have that company provide medical services and take care of patients in terms of health coordination, a continuum of care, and really provide all of the needs and benefits that Medicaid patients require. The benefit to the state is that they were able to pay an advance amount of money as opposed to having individuals come and be reimbursed on a fee-for-service basis. Off the top, this arrangement saved the state of Florida about 8 to 10% of its annual budget. It also shifted the burden of loss to the managed care organizations or to an HMO. So it provided considerable cost savings to have companies like WellCare get paid in advance and then provide the services as were needed and required. Florida, of course, would audit the companies, make sure that the health care was provided, and also from time to time would ensure that the company was meeting all of the necessary health care standards. This case does not involve instances of false doctors or false claims or non-existent patients. In fact, all of the testimony was quite clear that the HMO performed in an extraordinary way and actually exceeded contractual obligations and conceded contractual expectations with the state. In 2002, Florida passed a legislation known as the 80-20 statute, which is somewhat similar to what we now see in the Affordable Care Act. It's a medical loss ratio statute that provides essentially that if you pay or if you spend less than 80% of your premium dollars, then you have to return the difference to the state. In other words, if you spend 78% of your premium dollars for the provision of health care, then you have to pay back 2% to the state. On the other hand, if you expend 82% of your health care dollars, of your premium dollars, for the provision of behavioral health care, then you don't have to give any money back to the state. And this has become a very, very commonplace type of MLR requirement in healthcare. And as I said, the Affordable Care Act has a provision. In that instance, the Department of Health and Human Services decided to regulate how to do the calculation, and literally there were volumes and volumes written about how the calculation should be done, and in particular, it provided industry with fair notice, the opportunity to comment, and a regulatory dialogue on how to properly handle the calculation. In this instance, ACA, the state agency in Florida, decided intentionally not to regulate. In other words, not to prepare or promulgate any form of rulemaking, even though it was required to do so under state statute. The 80-20 provision applies just to behavioral health care. It does not apply to other forms of medical services. And the focus was really on ensuring that individuals in Florida, Medicaid patients, have access to mainstream medical behavioral health care in the state. Previously, under the fee-for-service system, the Florida legislature determined that many Medicaid participants really didn't have the option of going to doctors other than those who would be reimbursed under Medicaid, and as a result, there often was a stigma attached to Medicaid recipients. Under the 80-20 statute and under the way in which the Florida legislature and the will of the people, the will of the state, intended was that there would be a broader acceptance of Medicaid patients in the medical community through private entities such as WellCare that could offer Medicaid patients the opportunity to go beyond traditional community mental health centers or state-funded medical health centers and instead get behavioral health care in more traditional form, for example, at physician offices and at private specialists. In response to the 80-20 statute, WellCare formed a related entity called a behavioral healthcare organization, or a BHO. These BHOs are very common in the behavioral healthcare practice areas. They are literally the hub of behavioral health care. They provide for individuals who are trained behavioral health care specialists who can coordinate care and really ensure that patients have a continuum of care and an analysis of their behavioral and medical needs, and also provide a degree of ongoing review and ongoing analysis of a patient's condition. This related party BHO was set up under the direction of in-house counsel for the company, as well as outside lawyers, one of whom had previously worked at a very high level at ACA, and who had also been literally the draftsman of the 80-20 statute. Once again, there was no regulation that prohibited the use of a BHO in connection with the 80-20 calculation. In fact, in this instance, the BHO was not a shell entity. It was an actual functioning corporation that provided these services and was appropriately certified. The BHO was audited by the state, disclosed to the state, and was determined to provide excellent services to Medicaid patients. There were no concerns about patient care, no concerns about an instance where the BHO was not performing adequately under its contract. In fact, other entities had also used related parties in connection with the 80-20 calculation. And this was told to high-level executives at the company by outside counsel, including the draftsman of the 80-20 statute. WellCare decided to use this related BHO as the core of its methodology for reporting under the 80-20 statute. Now, as I mentioned, there was no 80-20 regulation. There was a contract between the state and WellCare that reiterated the 80-20 requirement. But in doing the calculation, WellCare decided to adopt what it believed was a reasonable formula in responding to the 80-20 calculation. And this reasonable formula in the executives' minds was to use the expenditures that were being paid to the related party BHO. In other words, each year that was under analysis, the WellCare entity, the HMO, would pay approximately 78 or 79% of its premium dollars to the related party BHO, and then report back to the state an MLR of 78 or 79%, and also report back a modest payback as well to the state of Florida. There was nothing in the statute or the contract that prohibited this methodology. And once again, there was no regulation that said that this was an unacceptable methodology. Without question, the calculation approach taken by WellCare did have a financial benefit, and there was evidence at trial that the methodology saved the company a considerable amount of money that might otherwise have to be paid back to the state if, instead of calculating the 80-20 formula based on what was paid to the BHO, WellCare instead did its calculation based on what doctors ultimately received downstream. So without question, this arrangement had a financial benefit. So how did this turn into a criminal case? Well, enter a key TAM relator. Unknown to management, there was an employee who joined the company, having previously been at another public company, and joined with the intention of becoming a key TAM relator. At his other public company, he realized the benefits than what one might obtain financially by being a relator, and came to WellCare with the express purpose of trying to see if there was something that might entice federal prosecutors. We'll call the key TAM relator Sean. Sean befriended a financial analyst at WellCare, we'll call him Greg, who was a low-level analyst who was responsible for the mechanics of the 80-20 calculation. Greg had not read the statute, had not read the contract, but was given the responsibility of performing certain financial and mathematical tasks in doing the 80-20 payback. Sean got Greg to express reservations about how the calculation was done, and in particular, using a related party for the calculation. From time to time, Sean was able to get Greg to concede that perhaps this was not the right way of doing the calculation, and in fact might be fraud or even worse, might be criminal. Once again, there were no fake numbers, no fake patients. The real question was whether or not the methodology was correct, and in particular, whether or not the methodology in some way violated a Florida contract or a Florida statute. After getting information from Greg, Sean went to see a very well-connected lawyer in town who is a key TAM lawyer, key TAM plaintiff's lawyer. We'll call him the lawyer. The lawyer is very connected politically, gives money to political organizations and politicians, and was also instrumental in having Sean go back to Greg and work him over some more in terms of getting information about why Greg believed that there might be something wrong here with the calculation. Sean was very successful, and obviously Sean and the lawyer saw the financial benefits of a key TAM case, and they went to the United States Attorney's Office, where they had a very hospitable reception. The United States Attorney's Office decided to involve the FBI and the Office of Inspector General, and they wired up Sean, and he went back into well care and spent over 800 hours talking to people in the company and getting them to speculate about how this calculation was done and whether or not it was correct under the Florida regulatory framework. Most of the employees, candidly, had not read the statute or the contract, nor had they dealt with the Florida bureaucracy in terms of whether or not it was an acceptable calculation, but many expressed doubt whether or not it was acceptable. And in addition, many employees were quick to say that this calculation methodology had a profit impact on the company and, in fact, was economically advantageous to WellCare. With these tapes in hand, the U.S. Attorney's Office went to a federal magistrate, obtained a search warrant, and one day 200 agents showed up at the WellCare offices and did a massive raid. The agents described it as a shock and awe raid, which was intended to present to employees the need to come clean in their minds. To a person, the employees cooperated, answered all the questions, and the testimony revealed at trial that literally no one knew why those agents were there. Nonetheless, the agents were able to present a great deal of press coverage. As a public company, WellCare lost almost immediately a great deal of its equity in the markets. In fact, for a period of time, the company had its trading suspended, and there was, needless to say, a firestorm of press coverage regarding the agents going in under these circumstances. The agents decided to proceed by a search as opposed to a subpoena for maximum impact on the company. At the risk of losing its government contracts and at the risk of debarment, WellCare decided to hire a new management team. It ended up disassociating itself from the old management team and did what many public companies do, a deferred prosecution agreement with the United States government, where it paid back an amount in excess of $90 million. According to the government's theory, the shortfall as a result of using this methodology was approximately $30 million over the period of time. The company paid treble damages, agreed to cooperate, and then as part of this arrangement, blamed former management for engaging in wrongful activity. At the time of the raid, the politically connected lawyer and also local politicians who had also received great benefits from this lawyer in terms of campaign contributions made very public statements that there were instances of wrongdoing that should be penalized and should be criminalized. The case went to trial on the prosecutor's regulatory theory that the only expenses that should count towards the 80-20 calculation were those expenses paid to downstream providers, to doctors at the community level or community mental health centers, as opposed to payments to a related party, BHO. The prosecutors based this analysis not on a regulation, but on their interpretation of not the contract and not the statute, but on certain letters that from time to time were sent from ACA to the HMO, to WellCare. These letters were referenced at trial by regulatory lawyers called by the government, and the letters were recognized by these lawyers as non-binding and, in fact, as violative of the Florida requirement that any communication be done through rulemaking. The letters had no force of a rule, and in fact, the lawyers said that they could be disregarded. Nonetheless, the prosecutor's theory was you couldn't count a related party BHO. ACCA, for example, had never taken that position until the raid. After the raid, ACCA took the position that under its regulatory framework, payments to a related party, BHO, could not be counted towards the 80-20 calculation. Once again, it did not do so in the framework of a regulation, but instead did so in an informal letter to the company and in an informal letter to the United States Attorney's Office. In effect, the federal prosecutors had now filled the gap left by Florida regulators and had imposed, through an indictment, their own theory of what regulation should apply and how the calculations should be done. The case was tried over a 3.5-month period. The government called as witnesses outside counsel who had given advice to the company and who testified under oath that the 80-20 calculation followed by the company was in fact reasonable and nothing prevented the company from counting as its expenses under the 80-20 calculation the payments to a related party, BHO. Under a variety of motions filed by the government, they were permitted to introduce wealth evidence about how much money the executives made, their stock holdings, their options, and their overall wealth. In addition, the government was permitted to introduce evidence of a restatement, an accounting restatement that the company had done after new management came in which they adopted the new sort of approach of doing the calculation, which was consistent now with the one proposed by the federal prosecutors after the fact. Following a three-and-a-half-month trial, the jury deliberated for over 3 weeks. It was unable to reach a verdict on nearly all the counts or acquitted on nearly all the counts. However, it did convict the defendants of 1 year's submission, which subjected the defendants to a potential prison sentence of 18 to 20 years. The case then proceeded to sentencing, and the government, under the sentencing guidelines, attempted to get a sentence in that range of 18 to 20 years. The judge substantially departed and rendered sentences in the area from probation to 3 years. The jury was, in fact, had been hung for several days, and the judge issued what's called an Allen charge, which attempts to put some pressure on juries to reach a decision. What this case clearly involves, without question, it really hits all the issues of over-criminalization that many of us have been dealing with. Question of over-federalization, where we see the federal government coming in and playing a role in what would otherwise be a state issue or a state agency issue. Here we have ACCA and Medicaid and a state contract. Rather than allowing the state to interpret its own contract and statute, we have the federal government, through federal prosecution, attempting to do that. Clearly, we have an instance of criminal statutes being used to regulate economic activity. There's no doubt that these federal prosecutors had a problem with the approach or the methodology that was taken, and in the absence of Florida regulations, the federal prosecutors decided to fill that void and, in effect, regulate through this criminal prosecution. The criminal prosecution was done through the use of the federal health care fraud statutes, which many of us know are written very broadly and essentially define fraud as fraud and allow the jury to make determinations of fraudulent conduct with very little guidance on what fraud actually is. It also implicates the politics of overcriminalization. There's no question now in these cases that we see the importance and the power of key TAM lawyers who have direct access to federal prosecutors and really have a seat at the table of decision-making when criminal prosecutions are brought. And finally, we have questions of fair notice and the absence of mens rea, where we have an instance that literally the executives had no knowledge that this new methodology would be required, and in fact no opportunity to comment or respond, and instead acting in good faith, had a calculation methodology approved by two lawyers, and a third lawyer who was the general counsel also charged, as well as a fourth lawyer who was not charged but testified as in-house regulatory counsel that he saw nothing wrong with the calculation. So it really now has all of the indicia of an over-criminalization case, certainly a case study in instances where the government has overreached, where we've all been dealing with instances where the criminal laws are being used inappropriately to regulate economic behavior. And the case is now ready to go up to appeal. What is significant about the U.S. Clay appeal is that it directly tees up the issue of regulatory compliance and reasonable regulatory compliance in light of a framework that may not be all that clear to the regulated industry. In the 11th Circuit, which covers Florida and Alabama and Georgia, there's a case of very important significance. It's a case that the regulated community is aware of. It's United States White versus Whiteside, which was decided in 2002. And Whiteside is critical because it provides a role for judges in the courts to play in instances of regulatory-related prosecutions. In other words, Whiteside provides and holds that if a person has a reasonable response to a regulatory framework, then that person cannot be prosecuted criminally because there's an absence of actus reus. In other words, Whiteside, instead of focusing, as many courts do, on issues of mens rea, whether or not you had good intent, Whiteside instead focuses on the critical issue of actus reus in the area of enforcement, criminal enforcement, when it deals with regulated issues. The Whiteside court holds that it's up to the judge to take a hard look at the regulatory framework, to take a look at whatever statutes or contracts are available, if there's regulations available or administrative court decisions. All of those come within the analysis of the judge in overseeing a criminal prosecution. And in dealing with a complex regulatory scheme, if a judge determines as a matter of law that the response by the regulated entity or regulated person was not objectively unreasonable, then the judge enters an acquittal as a matter of law. And that can be done at the trial court level or at the appellate level. In Whiteside, the court distinguished between actus reus and mens rea and decided that notwithstanding bad mens rea, we're not even going to look at the specific intent of what the regulated person was engaged in. Instead, we're going to look at the key question of whether or not, as a matter of law, the actual act itself violated or actually resulted in a crime. In other words, in looking at the regulated framework, in looking at the statute, the contracts, and so forth, if the court, as a matter of law, determines that there was a reasonable response, then there's no actus reus. And in the absence of actus reus, there's no crime. The Whiteside court looked at, among other things, which are often common in these kinds of prosecutions, instances where reasonable people may disagree, where there might be a battle of experts, and in fact, there might be instances where the regulations or the regulatory framework are ambiguous. In the Clay case, there was actually a very well-known medical economist who testified on behalf of the defense and testified that the regulatory response to the 80-20 calculation by using this related party entity was entirely reasonable and, in fact, common in the industry and, therefore, was not false. So that's where the case is right now. It's being teed up to the 11th Circuit. Oral argument is going to be heard in early October, but it's probably the most significant case now percolating through the courts, where there's an opportunity for the judiciary to say that we have a role in policing over criminalization, and that role is to take a hard look at federal prosecutorial decisions, and if we believe that the regulated person acted reasonably, objective reasonableness is the touchstone, then we're going to find as a matter of law that there's no actus reus and therefore no crime.
Paul, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, hi, thanks. John did an excellent job there. First of all, I want to thank the Federalist Society for having this teleforum and its work on overcriminalization. And thank you, John, for moderating this discussion, all the work you and the Heritage Foundation does on this issue as well. Just a quick disclaimer, while I'm a senior fellow of the Administrative Conference, my views here are my own. I should also note that an amicus was filed in this case on behalf of the defendants by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and that was joined by the Reason Foundation and several law professors, Steve Salzberg at GW, Steve Smith at Notre Dame, Jeff Parker at George Mason, John Hasness at Georgetown, and Joe Antos, who's a healthcare expert at the American Enterprise Institute, and also the Washington Legal Foundation published a legal backgrounder on this case. Now, John discussed very well the key issue here, and that's the Whiteside case, where the court said that for criminal prosecution, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a defendant's statement, quote, is not true under a reasonable interpretation of the law, end quote. And the briefs make a compelling case that the defendant's interpretation was a reasonable one, even though there may be other reasonable interpretations that the government may prefer. I just wanted to also underscore what John said, that there were no Florida regulations explaining how to interpret this statute, which the key part was only eight words, quote, for the provision of behavioral health services, end quote. That's what the expenditures were supposed to be allocated to. So as John pointed out, there were no regulations in contrast to the 30-some ones at the federal level to determine these complicated green eye shade type medical loss ratios. Now, this case, I think, also should be noted because it demonstrates an example of prosecutorial abuse for invoking criminal sanctions against executives and corporate counsel and where prison sentences are meted out. When there's administrative and civil remedies not only are available here, but were used, these civil remedies were used against other providers for essentially doing the same thing as WellCare, and where Florida did sue one of them for the same methodology and settled for $0. I would like to point out that the U.S. Attorney's Manual specifically requires prosecutors to consider non-criminal remedies before invoking criminal prosecution. It says here, prosecution should be declined because there exists an adequate non-criminal alternative to prosecution, such as the sanctions available under alternative means of disposition. And they give a couple examples. Examples of such non-criminal approaches include civil tax proceedings, civil actions under the securities, customs, antitrust, and other regulatory laws. And it says another potential useful alternative to prosecution in some cases is pretrial diversion. And as John pointed out, there was that. There was a deferred prosecution agreement. So here you have the government coming in and doing a double whammy here and invoking a criminal remedies when civil administrators are more appropriate. I just want to just throw out another case that I think is good for listeners to note of a related case in the district court. It's pending in the 8th Circuit. The district court in Missouri threw out a civil False Claims Act case because of Medicare and Medicaid billing dispute by an anesthesiologist group that centered around the interpretation of when a patient, quote, emerges, end quote, from anesthesia and into the recovery room. Now, that regulatory term was ambiguous, and the district court said, quote, where a regulation is unclear, a defendant's reasonable interpretation of any ambiguity belies the scienter necessary to establish a claim of fraud, end quote. Now, the Justice Department jumped in that case and said, well, wait a minute, if the regulations are kind of unclear here, the defendant has a duty to call up and consult with the government regulators to get a clarification. The court rejected that out of hand and said, look, there's no duty to do that. And this is an important quote here where it quote says, even if, quote, defendant's interpretation is opportunistic because it has a financial motive to interpret the regulation this way, end quote. And they went on to say there's no mens rea if a defendant, quote, takes advantage of a disputed legal question, end quote. So keep in mind that WellCare and other corporations have a duty to their shareholders to maximize their profits. So the government's trying to make some hay out of the fact that there was a profit motive here is totally unfair and unjustified. And that you know, even aggressive accounting practices are perfectly legitimate as long as they are legal. And as we're here, they were approved by their own counsel. So in short, this case, it's called Donegan versus Anesthesius Associates, reached the same conclusion as what John is arguing in the Clay case, as Whiteside did, but from a mens rea route rather than the actus reus route. And I should know that in this case, there is the actus reus Whiteside issue presented, but the CEO in this case, Todd Farah, is also making a compelling mens rea argument as well, since he relied on advice of counsel and so forth, that there was no mens rea as well. Anyway, it seems to me that this case shows that the government would lose even if this case were a civil case, and all the more so in a criminal context where due process and the rule of lenity applies. If I may, I just may want to throw out a couple questions to John to see these are ones that the government kind of raises in their brief. John, what do you say to the government's argument that the defendants really never identified a reasonable interpretation of the statute for the methodology that they used? It was sort of an after-the-fact process.
Well, what's so compelling about this case, Paul, is that the state of Florida, through its regulatory arm, ACCA, never prescribed a single method for its calculation under the 80/20 statute. In the case at trial, there was expert testimony that the formula adopted by WellCare, which was to use the related party BHO, was in fact a reasonable one. So the case at trial reflected the evidence in real time, which was the BHO was in fact used for this calculation, and everybody reasonably believed that that was an acceptable way of interpreting the contract and the statute.
Paul, this is John. I want to make sure that we leave some time for our patient audience members. So
why don't we open it up,
and let me ask a question to sort of get us started. So it seems to me that you could look at the issue, John, that you've outlined as either an actus reus issue or a mens rea issue, but the Whiteside provides a valuable stopgap, if you will, to prevent overcriminalization, to say that, look, you cannot definitively say that something is in fact a false statement or that one had an intent to create a false or to make a false statement if a regulation is vague and the position taken by the defendant is an objectively reasonable one. There may be other objectively reasonable ones, but if so long as his interpretation or her interpretation is objectively reasonable, no crime. That the Whiteside opinion has been adopted by three other circuits, the First, Eighth, and Tenth, but so far as I know, none of them has addressed the issue about what role the jury plays in making a Whiteside determination versus the role that the court plays in making a Whiteside determination. And I wanted to know whether you could talk a little bit about that, and then we'll open it up to questions.
And John, I think that's a critical issue. You've hit kind of the nail on the head. The government is arguing that literally the entire Whiteside issue should be thrown to the jury. mens rea and actus reus. And obviously in criminal law, sometimes actus reus determinations are in fact made by jurors. In this instance, though, and the importance of Whiteside, is that the court held that judges, rather than jurors, need to take the responsibility for analyzing complex regulatory schemes and making a determination as to whether or not the response was objectively reasonable. That is to say that only the court has the experience, the knowledge, and the ability to make that determination rather than jurors. So the real critical question is whether or not the 11th Circuit will reaffirm the important role that judges have in this context, which is to analyze the regulatory framework and decide whether or not the actus reus element is present.
Christian, let's turn it over to you. If there are no questions pending, I've got another one, but I think we should take some questions from the audience.
Okay, well let's open up the line. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Yeah, let's give it a moment.
All right, looks like we do have one question to get to.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm sorry I came in a little bit late, and maybe you already answered this, but I'm curious, how much did this third-party relator make out of all this?
Very, very good question. North of $8 million.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
John, while we're waiting for another caller, you talked about the fact that there were at least one other, I think you said there were two other Florida healthcare providers that had adopted a similar interpretation and were handled administratively. There was a settlement. They weren't required to pay any dollars, but they had to adopt the government's interpretation in terms of their future dealings. Should that have a – so it's one thing to make a normative argument saying, hey, it's unfair to prosecute us criminally if they're being handled civilly. Should that also be a legal issue? Should that somehow have gotten involved in the trial in terms of determining whether a crime had been committed?
Well, you know, I think that issue really highlights the importance of why this needs to be analyzed as an actus reus issue as opposed to mens rea. For a variety of reasons, as an evidentiary matter, the judge excluded a lot of that information from the jury, finding that it wasn't related to mens rea, wasn't related to the defendant's state of mind, and therefore should not come in. But that information does provide, I believe, a profound impact on the judge's determination as to whether actus reus existed. In this instance, other providers similarly situated were sued administratively, not prosecuted criminally, but sued administratively for a similar formula. And on the eve of administrative proceedings, ACA dismissed and settled without imposing any penalties or payback provisions, but simply required them going forward to adopt this new regulatory scheme that was imposed by the federal prosecutors, the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yeah, this is Paul. I think this also shows more of a normative, maybe not a legal, on how this was an abusive criminal prosecution by the Justice Department, where Florida was quite capable, thank you very much, to handle their own contractual disputes with the providers here. And you had, I guess, the federal government invested with a raid of 200 FBI agents, and they figured that, well, we've gone this far, we better continue with a criminal prosecution lest we look that this was actually an abuse of our process.
And let me also say, I don't think we can ignore the political power that key TAM lawyers now have in the process. And recently, the Department of Justice issued a statement saying that we look forward to dialogue with key TAM lawyers on issues of enforcement.
Right.
And they are incredibly politically powerful and play a very significant role. And that role is not being dictated by public morality, but instead making a buck.
John, this is Christian Corgan. We actually have three questions now pending. So let's go right to one.
Hey, guys, this is Jack Park. Real good job. Where do you think this will be argued, Miami?
It's going to be argued in Jacksonville in early October.
You said early October. Okay,
yeah.
Thank
October
you.
2nd, right, John?
I think that's it. Yes, Paul.
Yeah. Friday, October 2nd.
When do you find out your panel?
About a week before.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, in our focus groups, people who tended to be more conservative or libertarian-oriented were much more favorably inclined to the defendants overall than those coming from a different perspective.
Christian, should we go to the next question?
Yep. We have two more questions pending.
Hi, this is Chris Green from Ole Miss Law School. I'm curious about the exercise of prosecutorial discretion here. I mean, that's just kind of notoriously a completely lawless arena in the law under a bunch of precedents. I would think in this case they would presumably have gone to at least some health policy branches of the federal government. Obviously, there's no notice and comment. I mean, I've always, for a while, thought, you know, something kind of like Overton Park scrutiny would be great if we could just, you know, require prosecutors to explain themselves. Obviously, that's a pretty radical move. Are there any arguments along those lines that you're making?
Well, we did at the trial level. We had a PhD in medical economics who was a nationwide expert. The government hired an accountant to simply add up the numbers in accordance with their theory, their rulemaking. That accountant had no healthcare experience at all. So there was a considerable disparity in terms of, you know, knowledge, actual healthcare knowledge. That, I think, will play a role, again, in the actus reus analysis, but obviously it's not always persuasive to a jury. But you're absolutely right. You would expect that the government would have vetted the issue with healthcare economists at a very high level, and they did not in this case.
Yeah, and to comment further on that, unfortunately, prosecutors have basically absolute prosecutorial discretion. There are some limits in terms of selective prosecution if you can show that it was done for unconstitutional reasons. But this underscores why these guidelines, which are there in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, are followed in the breach, and there's really no adult supervision, shall I say, at the Justice Department, making sure that these prosecutors out there in the hinterlands are trying to put notches in their belt. And if I'm not mistaken, John, wasn't the prosecutor in this case the same one that did the Yates case, the involving the fish?
It was the same office, Paul. That's
same
right.
Office, okay.
Yeah. And I should add that when federal agents go in a very highly publicized raid, as here, the chances of there not being a prosecution are very limited for obvious reasons.
Thanks.
All right, last question.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to find the case. Do you have a case site for the one below?
There's no reported decision below, but
there
it's
isn't, okay.
Yeah, but it's in the 11th Circuit. Yeah, it's if you need the citation, it's number 14-12373 pending in the 11th Circuit.
Okay. Also, on this rule that they allegedly breached, what was the word from inside counsel? Did inside counsel review on this, or did we have any knowledge of that?
Absolutely. Both in-house counsel and the chief regulatory lawyer at the company passed on the methodology and agreed it was reasonable. The general counsel was indicted as well, and the chief regulatory lawyer was determined to be an alleged co-conspirator, but was not indicted.
Holy cow.
Exactly. Let me follow up.
go ahead.
Let me follow up with that, John. So the general counsel, his trial was severed, and I gather they're waiting to see what happens on appeal before trying him. So in light of the fact that you had an alleged unindicted co-conspirator and the other indicted alleged co-conspirator was not part of that trial, how did the evidence or did the evidence come in about a reliance and counsel defense?
It was in some respects a reliance on counsel light defense. The general counsel himself was unable to testify because of health reasons, and his case was severed. The chief regulatory officer, also a lawyer, healthcare lawyer, did testify under a grant of immunity. He testified that the methodology was reasonable.
So, in other words, his testimony you think was more helpful to the defense than to the prosecution?
Absolutely. As was the testimony of other outside counsel that, for some reason, the government called. The government actually called three lawyers in the case, and all three lawyers said it was reasonable.
Okay, Christian, do we have any other calls left? Any other questions? Christian, any other questioners?
We did get one more. Here we go.
Okay.
Yes, hello. This is Linda Knight in Nashville, Tennessee. You mentioned earlier that some of the folks involved in this had made substantial political contributions. Is it known whether the executives that are being prosecuted or maybe a PAC that this company had made contributions to candidates of an opposite political persuasion from the key TAM lawyer? Is there any?
The short answer to that, Lynn, is absolutely yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was well known as well.
None of that came in at the trial, I take it?
No, not a word of it. But the defendant's wealth did.
What was the government's theory for introducing the defendant's wealth? Since that obviously might have had an impact on how the jury would view these defendants.
The theory which the judge adopted was that anybody who makes a lot of money at a public company might have an incentive to cheat.
Even though, as I said in this other case, the court said clearly that even an opportunistic interpretation of a regulation that maximizes profits is not evidence that mens rea. But the prosecutors, as John said, try to bring that in because they know that kind of information will bias the jury. And I think that is another issue on appeal, if I'm not mistaken, that the wealth evidence should not have been introduced. Is that right, John?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, last time I checked, making money per se is not a crime.
Well,
do we have any other
say,
questions?
Though, in fairness, John, very quickly, for many jurors, it is.
All right, fair enough.
We do have one more question pending. If our questioner or caller promises to be brief, I think we can get it in.
Great.
Buzzer from the brief.
You're on.
This is Manny Foster from the Reason Foundation. Excellent presentation. Just a real quick question. How significant was the role of the rule of lenity below, and how meaningful do you think it might be this time around?
I don't think it's going to have much application because the rule of lenity would apply to the actual fraud statute itself, which is not under attack. Rather, it's the interpretation of the actual calculation and the absence of actus reus. Obviously, we all love the rule of lenity. It was not an issue at the trial level or on appeal.
Okay.
Would that issue, though, John, be available for the mens rea aspect in terms of interpreting the regulation that...
It would have been wonderful to get an instruction from the judge on that issue in terms of you know, how the mens rea piece should have been analyzed by the jury, but that didn't happen.
Okay.
Okay,
and
go ahead.
Yeah, I think we've exhausted all the questions. I'll leave it up to you, John, for any final thoughts or for the panelists.
Yeah, well, I don't know, Paul, John. Obviously, good luck with the case. Whether you have any any closing thoughts. I thought this was a very provocative discussion. I want to thank you both for participating, and obviously to the Federalist Society for putting this on. To those of you who are listening who are not members of the Criminal Law Practice Group, I would urge you to consider joining. But with that, let me turn it to you guys to see whether you have any closing thoughts.
Just very quickly, I think all of us are trying to deal with issues related to the executive and legislative branch. Here's an instance where the judicial branch can play a significant role in limiting overcriminalization.
And just briefly, too, I think, again, this is a good example that shows what's wrong with overcriminalization on all fronts, and I think we're looking forward to a favorable outcome in the 11th Circuit, and there's going to be a Federal Bar Association webinar later this week on this subject, so you may want to listeners tune in to that one as well.
Okay, are we done, Christian, or did you have any announcements?
Yeah, well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank all three of the participants today, and thank you to our audience. Just a reminder that you could find the recording of this teleform call as a podcast on our website at fedsoc.org. In about 24 hours, and as well as all of our previous Teleform conference calls. So, and be sure to check the website as we are listing new Teleform conference calls on the site almost daily. So, until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.